I'm Afshin Ratansi, and welcome back to Going Underground, broadcasting all around the world from the UAE on the 61st anniversary of the creation of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. Today, amidst the Holocaust, arguably not Palestinian, not to do with liberation, and not organized. And today, NATO nations arming the Gaza genocide and enforcing starvation of 2 million in Gaza will be preparing for tomorrow's start to 3 weeks of NATO preparation in Germany for war on China, Russia and Iran. Baltops 25 is billed as an attempt to strengthen the combined response capability in the Baltic Sea. According to British scholar Professor Richard Sakwa, we are in a second Cold War predicated on a perversion of Marx and Hegel, headed now for a single mega conflict. He charts this from Yugoslavia to Ukraine to Gaza to Taiwan in the culture of the Second Cold War. The Kent University's Emeritus Professor of Russian and European Politics joins me again from Canterbury in the UK. Professor Sakwa, thank you so much for coming back on the show. It's been quite a while. Not much has happened. Actually, a lot has happened. As if to promote your new book, and I want to get onto the book in a second, I better first ask you, given the NATO exercises are in the offing, what do you think of, in the past few days, Chancellor Merz of Germany, horribly unpopular chancellor within Germany, saying 50 billion euro more to Zelensky, the financing, I suppose, of the missile program to target inside Russia rather than the actual German missiles themselves, and I will do everything possible to prevent Nord Stream 2 from being launched, so no cheap gas this winter for Germans. How do you characterize it?
One could almost say it's a type of suicidal policy. It's taken, ideology to the point of self-destruction. I mean, obviously, Nord Stream is highly controversial, especially since Donald Trump suggested a few weeks ago that the United States may take it over and supply the gas. So that's a riposte not just to Russia, but also to the United States. Plus, of course, the larger German question is that Merz represents a complete repudiation of any lingering visions of Ostpolitik, of pan-continental unity, and, you know, in a sense of rapprochement. But I have a feeling, as you say, you've mentioned Hegel, Hegel said, the owl of Minerva flies at dusk. I fear that we're approaching dusk at this time, which, of course, is awful in certain ways, but it may finally reveal the deeper structures of international politics today.
Yeah, there's some kind of scheduled negotiations in Istanbul, but Zelensky not really cowed by anything. And Western Europe very much to the fore, as you say in your book, wanting to continue this war. But tell me why, I suppose I should start with, even before talking about the book, although you introduced the book with it, how you have sort of been blacklisted. You talk about censorship of ideas, without which, of course, no one in Western Europe, elites or the masses, can understand why upwards of maybe a million have been slaughtered in Western Europe in the worst conflict since World War II.
Yeah. No, you're absolutely right that it's a type, the public sphere, that sphere of debate with a lively media and so on, has been very much limited in the last few years. And that's a classic feature of a Cold War, where ideology takes the place of dialogue, where the language of threat takes the place of diplomacy. And I'm afraid that's where we've got. Just to say on diplomacy, you mentioned Istanbul, that both sides have, in principle, gone away and are supposed to be devising the memorandum or document which outlines their position, and then there may be a final follow-up meeting, perhaps precipitated by a meeting between Trump and Putin, Trump and Putin, or something like that. Because it's quite clear that if we are going to get out of it, we cannot rely on the European powers, who seem to be intent on deepening the war, whereas Trump simply says it's got to end. And the United States, there's the idea that they may just walk away. But ultimately, any deal will have to be, to make it stick, will have to have Washington behind it. And of course, possibly China, Brazil, and some other impartial mediators.
Yeah, I mean, Trump hasn't earmarked any more funds to finance Zelensky in addition to the Biden drawdowns. So it's really a case of his selective briefing. Did it disturb you when he thought that Russia was not retaliating to Ukrainian strikes, but was just lashing out at Ukraine and how he said that he hadn't even been briefed there'd been an assassination attempt on Vladimir Putin. No sign of Tulsi Gabbard, the director of national intelligence there. It's all the Kellogg Cornflake Coalition Provisional Authority Baghdad General Kellogg.
It seems that Donald Trump literally is a loose cannon, and that basically, whichever the way the wind is blowing at the last person he's talked to, he's pointing that cannon. Well, by cannon, the firing, of course, is a tweet, a posting on his Truth Social or X. So that, of course, is the cannonball, which he launches one way and another. But he has some, you know, Trump is like that, as we know. But at the same time, there's a deep Trump, and the deep Trump understands that it makes sense to have rapprochement with Russia. And that's really put the European powers in a panic, which seems bizarre, because he's finally possibly going to break that logjam of this, as you mentioned, this awful war on our European continent.
I mean, fundamental to the targeting, I mean, I do want to return to those issues, but as you talk about it in the book, to the targeting of yourself so that you were not able to contribute an article to a journal, is the fact that you continue to use the word the war was provoked. How hard is it over there in you're in Canterbury, in Britain, to talk about the conflict in Western Europe being provoked, something that is just normal in the United States, in the whole of the rest of the world? It's just this rump of Western Europe where you're not allowed to say that.
Yeah. I don't know. It doesn't certainly get into the public sphere. We have to say that the mainstream media has quite an effective blockade on all of this. But the good news is that the blockade is beginning to be breached. I think people are beginning to understand, because we're now in the fourth year of the war, and, you know, the same length as the First World War. And by the end of the First World War, there was actually a vigorous debate about the merits of that war. Surprisingly enough, there hasn't been much so far in the United Kingdom and Europe, but it's emerging. We've seen that in the German vote, AfD, and of course, Sarah Wagenknecht, Die Linke, and others, and of course, the Romanian election over the last few months, however, whatever the result. So I begin to feel that there is beginning to be a backlash against the militarism, against the war fever that has seized the continent, and the absurdity of the positions of the European Commission, and indeed the German leadership, is, I think, you know, we're beginning to see the backlash.
Well, it doesn't seem to be, by in terms of action, arguably. Yes. I know that the leader of the opposition, I know the leader of the opposition in our country, said somehow that the Gaza genocide was a proxy war. I don't know against who, all Arabs, but Kerry Banadok is her name, and she then said it was a proxy war on Russia through Ukraine, sort of thing that lands you in trouble from the Integrity Initiative and MI6 cutouts. Was that a mistake on her part? And it doesn't seem to have been followed up much in the British press. Do they finally understand that it's a proxy war?
No, I think that Kerry Badenoch has, how can I put it, under-delivered in all sorts of ways. But as you say, that's a rare slip. Before our last election, July 2024, Nigel Farage, the leader of Reform, which is way ahead in the polls, also raised some questions about the war and the provoked character of it. But he tentatively did that, and as you remember, a huge backlash against him, and he's been very quiet in the months since then. So, but the fact that he dared to say that a few months ago is perhaps a sign, indeed, that there are people out there who understand the deeper logic of this conflict.
Farage's Reform Party, of course, leading in the polls. You were kind of, I mean, I don't know whether blacklist is too extreme a word, not so much maybe for the provoked issue, but they cited the fact that you had spoken to Aaron Maté. We've had his father on, a Holocaust survivor himself, Gabor Maté. He works for Grey Zone. We have the founder, Max Blumenthal, on this show frequently. Why would a journal, you might want to tell us, be targeting you for speaking to a Canadian journalist who writes for an American outlet?
Yeah, no, it's utterly bizarre, this whole idea. And as you can see, there were a whole stack of emails in the in within the framework of the successor to the Integrity Initiative, which I won't go into detail, but which does, as you say, just for talking to Aaron Mate, who, as you know, and Max Blumenthal, one of the most the most perceptive analysts of what's going on in the world today. So it's not allowed. And of course, in that attack on me by the British Secret Service, they kept saying it's going to be hard to attack me because I'm knowledgeable, and so I knows what he's talking about. Which, in other words, knowledge nowadays is dangerous and it should be curbed. And so, but no, I go on. I'm, you know, continuing the work. So, unfortunately, touch wood, we still have the rule of law to some degree in the United Kingdom.
But it's still serious. So, I mean, if you watch, as I occasionally do, obviously being in the Middle East, in the new BRICS world, Britain has much less of an importance in the world. Yeah. You know, they just talk about domino theory and... So therefore, they would feel themselves justified in targeting scholars and feel themselves justified because this is not actually about Ukraine. This is about Russia trying to, I don't know, march up Whitehall.
Yes. No, that's the whole thing, isn't it? We know the Baltic Republics, Poland would say, if we don't stop Russia in Ukraine, then they're going to be marching on next to the West. And as you know, Lithuania, for example, is now building tank traps and all those, the tanks to ditches, barbed wire and the rest. War fever has seized the European continent. And of course, the consequence is militarization and the other thing, the securitization of public debate. That, in other words, everything's seen through a national security lens, it doesn't really understand. And this is, in a sense, an intensification of not just the war, but also the whole ideology which caused the war in the first place, which is the vision of a political West. You mentioned the BRICS, but this is a West which, a Cold War West shaped during the first Cold War, didn't dismantle itself at the end of the Cold War with Gorbachev at the end of the 1980s, early 1990s. In fact, it became more militant. It became more confident of itself. It claimed to be universal. Russia and, of course, China and some other states say, hang on, guys, this isn't the way the world works, and you're making illegitimate demands. And that ultimately is the root cause of this conflict, which is huge. I mean, it's as big as the first Cold War, that huge conflict, ideological conflict between communism and capitalism, democracy, as it were, against authoritarianism. And we've repeated it and got into a far deeper hole today than even we were up to the 1980s.
Professor Richard Sakwa, I'll stop you there. More from the author of the new book, The Culture of the Second Cold War, after this break. Welcome back to Going Underground. I'm still with the author of the new book, The Culture of the Second Cold War, Professor Richard Sakwa. Professor Sakwa, you were talking about how it is Cold War II, and it's as if you make the case in the book, the elites who were in the left, and say in the 60s or 70s, they were the ones protesting and so on. They took on the Marxist ideas of wanting to change the world, the Hegelian idea of eventually we'll get to this synthesis of two forms. And actually, but they didn't want communism. They didn't want socialism. They wanted neoliberalism. And they've got the sort of verve of Che Guevara, except for a system that is grossly unequal, that is increasing the gap between rich and poor. So they've kind of perverted. So all the music, the culture, all those elites were, I mean, Kaya Kallas and Ursula von der Leyen and all these names of Macron, they've all been schooled in it to philosophically understand it the way they do.
It's a paradoxical inversion. Instead of the march of history, or what Fukuyama, the end of history, leading to a type of progressive vision, it's in fact the opposite. It's a claim that the political West, that this Western world which we've established since 1945, is a type of universal modernity. This is how people should live. Anybody who doesn't accept that is not only illegitimate, but in some way profoundly evil. And it's this you know, extraordinarily complex inversion, as you say, where the left as well, some of the traditional left, has bought into that. The Greens in Germany, for example, as well, who've become the most militant apostles of this pseudo-Western universalism. Unfortunately, or well, unfortunately for us, it's generating conflict, as we saw Ukraine, in a sense, is embedded in that larger conflict. And of course, it also has huge blowback effects in our own societies. And we've talked earlier about the attempts to close down debate in Western societies, in the UK in particular. And, you know, the idea even of being a peacenik, you know, for against a war, is or against NATO, is now considered in the Labour Party illegitimate. It's very explicit that if you're in a Labour Party and oppose NATO enlargement and are for peace, you are quite likely to be expelled. And this is an astonishing development which undermines the very foundations of the political liberties which I believe should be at the core of Western society.
Yeah, I don't know what Zelensky's negotiators are going to do when they get back to Kiev, because Zelensky passed a law you're not supposed to negotiate with the Russians. That's completely against the law. I mean, I do also want to ask you, because you do talk about culture with the small c, I suppose, in the book, in your latest book as well, whether it was progressive boycotts of apartheid South Africa, the current BDS boycott of Israel, somehow that's been subverted. Somehow. It's a kind of left subversion of the left that they are the people now saying, and you talk about the soprano Netrebko, the conductor Valery Gergiev, Wimbledon, of course, in your country, is in our country, is coming up, the tennis players. This is why they want to destroy any element of Russia, its existence culturally, philosophically, at all.
Yeah, two things have come together there. You mentioned cancellation. I can't remember in history. I mean, sanctions are one thing, boycotts are another. But the cancellation of a whole society, its culture, its arts, and so on, is something, you know, a phenomenon which is absolutely astonishing. You know, within Ukraine, of course, the de-Russification has moved on from decommunization, the destruction of statues of Lenin, now to the entire extirpation of a culture, and that, of course, has blown back into the West as well. And all of that is connected to this whole discourse of decolonization. We've had it in the West as part of the woke phenomenon of the last decade, where you have to decolonize our curriculum at the university. And it's a misappropriation of the idea of colonization in Ukraine, but also the idea that you know, Russia represents an imperial power which really has to be fought back by all means, including measures, including, for example, banning direct flights to Moscow, which never happened even in the first Cold War. So we really are in a very, very difficult and dark place. And I'm not sure that anybody knows how to get out of it. At the moment, we're still in an escalating cycle. Trump, in his bizarre, incoherent, inconsistent manner, actually is trying to stop it, which is quite peculiar. I mean, whether he can achieve it or not, who knows? But that I suppose. And some of his team, you mentioned Tulsi Gabbard. Well, she has actually, you know, as Director of National Intelligence, she is responsible for providing the daily brief to the president today, which I think suggests he is getting alternative information.
Yeah, and important will be definitions of words. I know it annoys both of us, this unprovoked invasion by Russia. Full-scale invasion is another word you hear on so-called corporate mainstream media. I've got to ask you why you use the word Cold War, and actually the West. You talk about the West, which, of course, in a BRICS world, people will go, you know, you're ignoring Latin America and Central America there. But obviously the coldness of the first Cold War was never cold, because so many millions of people were killed, wounded, or displaced in that one. And if this, and in this new Cold War too, of yours, by your definition, of course, since Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, and Syria, and so many in Libya, tens of millions killed, wounded, or displaced. It's not cold.
Yeah. Absolutely. It's a convention because a Cold War, by definition, is the war between major powers in the nuclear age, a war that they hesitate to fight directly, US, Soviet Union, today Russia or China. And indeed, India and Pakistan, we saw just a few weeks ago, as nuclear powers. So a Cold War, by definition, is a contest in conditions of nuclear, well, a threat of nuclear annihilation. But at the same time, you're absolutely right. There were endless proxy wars in the global south in the first Cold War. And today we're seeing, you're absolutely right again, the political West is increasingly isolated as the emergence of the, well, you could even, let's call it the Global East, the BRICS, the Shanghai Cooperation Organization, ASEAN even, a whole stack of organizations, the IOC, the Islamic Organization Conference, which is the largest, by the way, of all the international governmental organizations in the world. So you're, and there's a second block, a third block, sorry, there's the Western block, there's this nascent political East, Russia and China at its heart. And then, of course, there's the whole vast global south. So, in a sense, the third world is back, now called the global south or the world majority, which simply looks at this war in the global north with contempt. Why, they say, look, you started the First World War, you started the Second World War, guys in Europe and in within that sense, can't you stop it? And so you're absolutely right that we have to have a global perspective on what is going on.
If we put aside the threat of global annihilation, which is obviously a thread running in the culture of the Second Cold War, this new book of yours, is there a possibility that Western Europe itself could collapse in on itself? I mean, if you're going to use Hegel and Marx and the perversions of that in the book, you know, de Tocqueville was saying, oh, you know, Louis XVI tried to liberalize a little bit. It led to the French Revolution. If we look at the Second World War and the impact on Western Europe, obviously it was worse than the current situation in Ukraine. But actually, the whole place is rotten, as seen from the outside, as you just said. And actually, it is going to implode through its own forces because of its huge disparities of wealth that have been increasing and self-destruction of infrastructure.
Absolutely. So on the one side, we could, some people are now talking about the suicide of the West, the failure to invest in infrastructure and human capital as well, the educational systems, health services, certainly in the UK, under huge strain. But there's a deeper aspect to this as well, which makes this, what we're talking about, the culture of this Second Cold War, perhaps even more profound. And that is that the whole 500 odd years of Western dominance is now under challenge as never before. This civilizational West, which has always been accompanied by genocide, mass murder, you know, from Aztecs to the Incas to the peoples of the Caribbean, of course, in the United States, the native peoples, all the way, more or less, to this day. There's something in our civilization which has this endless drive for war when we do have an alternative. And I keep going on about the United Nations Charter system of 1945. At the end of the Second World War, humanity pledged to do it better. Never again. Of course, it's been many times again since then. But we do have, as it were, a lodestar, which does perhaps provide a type of path out of it, and that is to go to the idea of comity, of cooperation between the great powers. Again, I go that Trump, in his incoherent and opaque manner, is reaching towards this, to that vision of great power cooperation, which is at the heart of the United Nations Security Council. If you remember before the war, Putin said, let's have a big global conference, a type of Yalta too, of a second Yalta in which the five permanent members of the Security Council, with perhaps some others, you know, meet to discuss the what was then an intensifying security conference conflict in Europe. All of those ideas were neglected, and we ended up where we are today, a full-scale war, which, of course, is in the foothills of the Third World War.
Yeah, I mean, there have been leaks from the New York Times about this tripolar world that Trump it may well be announcing between Russia, the United States, and China. And maybe in a year's time, we'll say Xi Jinping was too lackadaisical about things. But given you're always talked about as a Putin puppet in Britain, I mean, I have to ask you then, given that history, was Vladimir Putin, was the Russian administration, successive ones, woefully ignorant about what was going on as they signed Minsk agreements, as they trusted the West, even before and after the 2014 coup? Should some of the blame for this go to Russia? And will it go to China in a year's time when that kicks off?
Well, just to say on this, I've recently been accused of being in Beijing's pay as well. So it's not just Moscow. But I'm waiting for the check.
You must be very rich.
Well, I should be if the accusations do have any truth in them. As for China, it's fascinating in this conflict, of course, that China well understands that if Russia is, you know, is defeated, what form defeat can take of a nuclear power, I simply don't know. But nevertheless, if Russia is significantly weakened, then, you know, the Western, the American neocons explicitly say, we're going to go after China next. So China is quite clearly... it's in its interest to ensure that Russia does not get significantly weakened. So I'm not sure he is being lackadaisical, that Xi Jinping is, and of course, he's offered his mediation services along with Brazil and Turkey and others. So there's things going on there. But as you say, was Russia swindled, bamboozled over Minsk? Quite clearly, yes. Because Minsk, the Minsk, two Minsk agreements of late 2014, early 2015, was, after all, a way to return the Donbass to Ukrainian sovereignty. But the vision which Russia always had was that Russia, that the Ukraine itself would be transformed from what I call a monist, a sort of ethno-cultural vision of a pure Ukrainian statehood, which has to be carved out from all this overlay of Russian and Russianism and communism. Instead of which, the book I'm working on now is about the Russo-Ukrainian war, and it's dedicated to the other Ukraine. That is a Ukraine which is tolerant, multi-confessional, pluralistic, inclusive. And if they'd done that to the Donbass, given it a degree of autonomy, that's all they wanted. They didn't want to separate as such at the beginning. They wanted autonomy. It's happened to Quebec. It's in Wales, in the United Kingdom. Why not? Why not? And of course, they refused. And still that issue is on the table. So Minsk in the old form is dead. But the vision which lay underneath it is still viable and is still one of the ways, core elements of the peace deal that may or may not emerge.
Professor Richard Sakwa, thank you.
Thank you.
That's it for the show. The Culture of the Second Cold War is out now. Our continued condolences to those suffering the impact of the US-UK EU-armed genocide in Gaza. We'll be back on Saturday with a brand new episode. Until then, keep in touch via all our social media. If it's not censored in your country, head to our channel, Going Underground TV, on rumble.com to watch new and old episodes of Going Underground. See you Saturday.